America, Inc. Arguing on behalf of Ms. Garcia is Attorney William S. Pocan. He will have 25 minutes and then 5 minutes in rebuttal. And arguing on behalf of Mazda Motor of America, Inc. is Jeffrey S. Fergal. He will have 30 minutes. The lawyers are timed by and those that little black box on the podium, on the lectern, is the timer, and you will see that it will light up. Red, green means go. Yellow means warning, you've got 5 more minutes, and red means stop. That's our system. And I should say, somewhat derelict, but I want to thank Amanda Todd, who's not in the courtroom, has been around, our public information officer, for setting up these meetings. She will not be with us tomorrow, so I want to thank her today, but I also want to thank Tina Nodolf, who is our marshal, who has been extraordinarily helpful in arranging for us. And Jeff Porter, who's behind all that equipment, is our sound man. He is not a court staff person, but has joined us in the 14 trips we've taken around the state since 1993. And I think you met, when you came in, Adri, who is there with the clerk's office inside you. So with that, all that said, counsel, Pocan.
Good afternoon. My name is Bill Pocan. My co-counsel, Vince Magna, joins me at counsel table. Also with us in court today is the petitioner, Del Garcia. On behalf of Del Garcia, Attorney Magna, and myself, I want to thank you for this opportunity to appear before you today. Del Garcia sent a letter to Mazda requesting a replacement vehicle under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. The issue in this case is whether the letter was sufficient notice under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. The real-world bottom line is that consumer pro se demands don't get much better than the one presently before this court. If this demand is not sufficient, we should give up once and for all the fiction that consumers can do this on their own, because this law will be anything but the self-enforcing consumer statute. And we believe that would be a shame for Wisconsin consumers. The Wisconsin Lemon Law requires the consumer to offer to transfer title to her vehicle in exchange for a replacement vehicle.
Counselor, is there any limit on when that offer can be made? In other words, if Mazda didn't find this sufficient, why didn't you just tender title, or had she already taken a new car by the time you knew their position was that it wasn't sufficient?
There is some question in the law whether there is a statute of limitations and what it is, but in any event, we would be within, most people believe it's probably the six-year contract statute, and we would be within that period, and she is still driving, although on a limited basis, the vehicle that's the subject of this matter.
Oh, all right. Thank you.
We believe that Ms. Garcia did indeed do so, did offer to transfer title to her vehicle with her letter. Del Garcia did not simply demand a replacement. She specified that she was seeking a replacement under the Wisconsin Lemon Law, which necessarily requires the consumer to return the lemon and provide the manufacturer with title. No one is saying that it's unnecessary for a consumer to offer to transfer title to the vehicle. What we are saying is that is exactly what Del Garcia did in this case by indicating she was making her demand for a replacement under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. The Court of Appeals dissent agreed, finding that the only reasonable way to read Del Garcia's letter is that she was notifying Mazda, pursuant to the Wisconsin Lemon Law, that she wanted a replacement car and would give up her car, including title, when Mazda supplied a replacement. The dissent stated that Del Garcia gave clear notice that she was offering to transfer title under the Lemon Law. As the Court of Appeals dissent asserted, it would be nonsensical for the owner of a lemon to demand a replacement under the Wisconsin Lemon Law and not at the same time be offering to transfer title.
Mr. Pocan, if I can interrupt for a minute, you indicated there was one issue, and I want to clarify that if I might. I understood that there was a second issue, and that second issue went to the question of whether or not your client had settled with the dealer and with Mazda. Is that not an issue also in this case?
It was an issue in the original case. We filed a motion to strike, which I understand is pending before this court, because we do not believe that it is appropriately before this court the way Mazda has brought it into this case. But in the original trial court, there was indeed a second issue, and that was whether there was a settlement agreement in this case. And, in fact, the trial court found that there were clearly issues of fact that precluded summary judgment, and therefore the trial court denied the summary judgment motion on that basis.
So, in other words, your position would be that that issue is not properly before us. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
And obviously your opponent says the contrary, feels that it is before us and that that's something we should address.
Yes, Your Honor.
So that's something else we're going to have to determine in this case.
I believe so, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
If it is before us, what's your position with regard to whether or not there was an actual settlement reached in this case?
Well, I believe there wasn't, and I think it's easier because at this point we're at summary judgment motion, and the dispute involves a series of facts. One is Ms. Garcia submitted via affidavit that she was told that she would have to pay a mileage charge, that she would have to pay sales tax, and that she would have to pay title fees. In addition, she was told they couldn't provide her the vehicle within 30 days, so they would need more time. So all of those facts, if indeed are true, it would be clear that the Lemon Law was violated. If indeed it was violated, there are several different reasons why on the law we feel that there is not a settlement agreement. One would be the argument, as I understand the other side made, was based on accord and satisfaction. For various reasons, we do not believe that there's an accord and satisfaction, and we did brief that in the event this court chose to look at that issue. Also, we believe that under the Lemon Law, it would be improper for a consumer to waive her rights, and we also briefed that issue in our materials.
Also, under the Lemon Law, the question I have is just how far do we go in this? We have. Do you agree that the language in the statute is plain and unambiguous? Do you think it's clear what has to be done in the statute 218? Do you think that is clear language?
Yes.
I'm speaking particularly of 218.017. My question is, it would seem to me that when you say a consumer could not act by themselves, okay, that's what you're saying. If this isn't clear, well, how far does one take that? If there was a letter that simply says, under the Lemon Law, I demand remedy, would that be sufficient?
No, it wouldn't, Your Honor. And I think that's clear in the Barron's case that the Court of Appeals reached, which I think is a correct decision. In the Barron's case, the court held that because the consumer did not indicate what remedy they were looking for, and in fact even raised an additional one that the statute didn't provide for, a repair, it was impossible for the manufacturer to respond within 30 days. In effect, it did not give them fair notice, fair opportunity to respond, and I believe that the Barron's Court was correctly decided.
But you're using, in a case not so long ago, we used the words functional equivalent of I forget exactly what, I remember what it is, but I don't want to talk about that case here. But the, what you're trying to do, and I'm just asking, is allow not the transfer of title, but the words, which you're saying the functional equivalent of what to transfer the title meant under the statute.
I'm not familiar with the precise case the justice refers to, but
it was in the Edgerton case. But it's where there was a requirement. This wasn't statutory; it happened to be under an insurance policy. But the requirement, when I read the statute, seems to be must offer to transfer title. That's what it says.
I would agree.
And the letter doesn't say must offer to transfer title.
We think it does in the sense that it says she's making her demand for her replacement under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. And the Wisconsin Lemon Law, just two sentences after the sentence that you just referred to, says that the consumer must transfer title in order to get the replacement vehicle. And I think it would be a different result if she just said in her letter, I'm looking for a replacement vehicle. Because then it wouldn't be clear to Mazda whether she was seeking it under the Lemon Law, under the UCC, under the Federal Magnuson-Moss Warranty Act, or what she was looking for. But in some ways, I think the notice here is superior notice because it puts everybody on notice of what the rules are. She says she's making her demand under the Wisconsin Lemon Law. And given that the Wisconsin Lemon Law requires shall transfer title upon receipt of the replacement vehicle, I don't think there's any issue. And in fact, we know in this case that Mazda was not confused. Mazda has conceded that it understood this to be a Lemon Law demand and that it understood what remedy she was seeking. And so I don't believe any manufacturer could reasonably have been confused, but even more important for this particular case, we know Mazda wasn't confused in this case.
But it seems to me you're arguing that the statute requires ABC, whatever it is, that the letter itself might not have touched the basis of ABC. But putting in the letter enough language, replacement, plus the words under the Wisconsin law, that is adequate because you don't have to restate the law.
Exactly.
That's your position.
Exactly.
Another position is that it's a consumer statute, that the consumer, and then this is just embroidering on Justice Wilcox's statement, the consumer has to do something that's clear enough. Doesn't have to use the exact language of the statute, but the consumer has to make his or her wishes as to a remedy clear enough so that the car people understand what's wanted.
Exactly.
Because those are two different kinds of rules. First one, had she left off under the law, you'd have troubles.
If she didn't reference the Wisconsin Lemon Law, we'd have big trouble. We wouldn't be here.
Right. On the other hand, under the functional equivalent, if you said I want a replacement, by definition that means I'm going to give you your car, you give me another car. So it's pretty clear what the remedy that is being sought. So it matters how the court phrases, if it at all agrees with you. Just a third alternative approach is to say, look, the law says shall, right? Shall is equivalent to must under most cases, right?
Yes.
Shall is shall. This is the language. It must give her a Lemon Law notification. Probably told her what language she's supposed to use.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Did they give her any notice when she bought the car about her rights?
I'm sure they probably did not. I don't believe they did in this case. And although it's not in the record, if the court is interested, I can tell the court what I generally know about that.
That's fine. Mm-hmm. but those are at least three alternative ways of viewing this language. There may even be more.
And I think that's fair, Your Honor, and I think the issue that's very important to us is looking at the purpose behind this law, and I think it is clear from the prior decisions of this court that, in fact, that this is a consumer protection statute, it's a remedial statute, and I think that's important. I think it's also important in cases that we've cited in our materials, like Alberte versus Anew and Madison versus Highland, how when interpreting statutes, you shouldn't look just at one sentence, but you should look at you should try to consider the purpose of the statute. And in fact, in the Madison versus Highland case, talking about the fact that remedial statutes should be liberally construed to suppress the mischief and advance the remedy which the statute intended to afford. And I think very important in this case is the fact that there really is no, if the court finds that the strict requirement that this notice was not good enough in this case, it will definitely be harming Wisconsin consumers, but at the same time providing no benefit to manufacturers. Because just as in this case, Mazda knew it was a demand under the Lemon Law and knew that she was seeking a replacement so it could comply, if this court holds that what she did was not sufficient, they put up a technicality that future consumers, and I'm especially concerned about pro se consumers, will have. I think any attorney, when following this, will, if nothing else, to be careful, will put in the language, "I hereby offer to transfer title." But this law was supposed to be a self-enforcing consumer protection law so that people would not necessarily need to employ an attorney and could do this on their own.
Counselor, why did this fall apart? I mean, if Mazda knew she was asking for a new vehicle, knew it was under the Lemon Law, why did it fall apart? Why doesn't she have a new vehicle? Excuse me.
I think it was based largely on greed on Mazda's part, not only what we see in this case, but what I know in general from practicing in this area. They were trying to get her to pay a mileage charge. They were trying to get her to pay some money towards taxes and title fees. They were looking for something beyond what the statute allows, because often consumers don't understand what their rights are, and in fact will go ahead and agree to that. And that's what I believe probably is the reason.
Okay, thank you.
Is there any kind of waiver here? The Court of Appeals summarizes, on October 26, Mazda contacted Garcia and said Mazda would provide a replacement vehicle. I mean, anything after that, how can they complain that they didn't get adequate notice?
I would agree with you that I don't know how they can possibly say in this case that they didn't know. They've admitted that they knew it was a Lemon Law demand and they knew that she was seeking a replacement. I think they're trying to win on a technicality, hoping that this court will so narrowly construe the law that because my client didn't say, "I hereby offer to transfer title," or something reasonably similar, that therefore she's out of the game on this vehicle. And I think that's unfortunate because a lot of consumers would not take this as far as Ms. Garcia. I think a lot of consumers would just go away. And I think that's part of the reason why we're here.
Counsel, amicus brief has been filed in this case by the state of Wisconsin. And they are advancing an interpretation that the statute is rendered ambiguous because the language of the statute is contrary to the purpose. That's not your approach, though, is it?
I don't necessarily disagree with the state, because if indeed I think the statute is clear, and I agree completely with the dissent, and I'm amazed, quite frankly, at the majority's opinion. But given that we do have a different reading of two well-informed individuals.
Including yourself in that?
Well, I don't know about me. I'm including the three justices, the three judges of the Court of Appeals. But I would think that from that, that would tell me that perhaps the state is right. And I've read the amicus also, and it's an interesting approach, and it would seem to me that perhaps they could be right.
Your position, as outlined by the chief, seems to be that with the qualification that you just gave, maybe the state is right, but a position that you've advanced is that the statute is clear, it requires the consumer to offer the title, and that indeed by saying I want a replacement pursuant to the Lemon Law, that because the Lemon Law specifically sets forth that the consumer shall transfer the title, that you've complied with the shall offer language. That's position at least set forth in your briefs, although an argument you are expanding to acknowledge the state's position and the value of that also. Is that fair to characterize your statement?
Yes, Your Honor.
Suppose Mrs. Garcia got this thing started with something less than specific language. What might she have done to screw these people up? I mean, is there any plausible way that she could have had her cake and eat it too? I mean, a new Mazda and her old Mazda?
I don't believe so, and I actually, the dissent took the exact same position that I do in these situations, that it is just not reasonable. The if that is Mazda's fear, that she somehow is going to trick them into getting a second vehicle, I just don't know how that could be, and their attorneys must be a lot smarter than I am, because I haven't figured out how you could possibly do that when the statute is so clear that she must transfer title to her vehicle and once she gets that replacement vehicle. But I don't know if that's Mazda's position, but I agree completely with the dissent.
There must be some reason why learned counsel, your opposing counsel, is pressing this. There's something. I'm just a poor country boy from up north. I don't get all the subtleties here. And then there must be something that they're concerned about that I don't quite see.
They haven't filled me in, Your Honor, beyond what's in their briefs, and I do not know what concerns or fears they might have, but I don't see it. I don't see a possibility where Ms. Garcia could have walked away with two Mazdas in this case. I don't. Basically, we see the Wisconsin Lemon Law as a law that was enacted to help, not hurt, people like Del Garcia. And our concern is under the Court of Appeals majority decision, the consumer's failure to use precise statutory terminology, in effect, becomes a gotcha that can be relied on by manufacturers to avoid the responsibility to consumers. And at the same time, we don't see most things in our law is a balancing, and we don't see that there is anything to gain here by requiring her to basically recite the statute, that Mazda gains anything. So if Mazda isn't gaining anything, and the party that the statute was designed to help is being hurt, we feel that it's an unreasonable reading, and under Alberte and Madison versus Highland, we don't see how that can be a reasonable reading of the statute. Our concern is that the statute was enacted to equal the unequal playing field between the parties in these cases. And for the unschooled pro se consumer, in effect, this case sort of unlevels that playing field again. And that doesn't seem fair, right, or consistent with what this statute is all about. And we think that that's an important issue, and that's why we're here. And I know there was another amicus in addition to the state of Wisconsin filed by the Consumer Law Clinic in Madison, and that was the gist of their position also, not so much to protect attorneys, because if I was drafting this notice, I would have put, I hereby offer to transfer title to be safe. But for a pro se consumer that is not going to dot all the I's and cross the T's, what is fair notice to the manufacturer? And I think in this case, what Del Garcia did is as much as we can reasonably expect. If she had attached a copy of the statute and put it in an envelope and mailed it and said, I want the vehicle based on Wisconsin lemon law, here it is, I comply with all of this, we probably wouldn't be here, because then it would have that language from 2C in writing. But what really is the difference? Well, everybody knew, in this case we know everybody knew, but how could a manufacturer reasonably argue that it did not understand when she said she wanted the replacement under the Wisconsin lemon law? We see the majority giving no legitimate assistance to manufacturers and harming consumers, and there seems no reason, nothing in support of this law that would make that reasonable. And we know in the amicus filed by the state, and I won't go through it all because they did it much better than I could, in great detail talking about the legislative history of this law, which I agree with the state is appropriate to look at given that this is a remedial statute. And my light is on, so I will end.
But you can finish the sentence, counsel.
That I believe that that given the remedial purpose of the statute, it's appropriate not because the law is ambiguous, but because it's a remedial statute, it's appropriate to look at that legislative history. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Representing Mazda Motor of America, Inc. is Mr. Fertel.
Please, the court, counsel, I'm privileged to give the argument here this afternoon on behalf of the defendants-respondents, both Mazda Motor of America, Inc., as well as Hall Imports, Inc. I was going to start out the argument this afternoon by addressing some of the court's well-stated and long-standing interpretations of statutory construction, mainly because of some of the statements that have been made in both the amicus brief as well as the plaintiff's brief. I think some of that has been cleared up as a result of the court's questioning here this afternoon, but a couple of points I wanted to emphasize. First of all, the state's indication that the legislative history of this statute is somehow relevant to this interpretation in this case because ambiguity can be created if, in fact, the language is contrary to the intent, is, I think, a novel, unsubstantiated legal statement. There's nothing I could find in the case law which would suggest that ambiguity is created in that fashion. In fact, this court has indicated time and time again that the primary resort when interpreting a statute is first to look at the language. And when the language is clear and unambiguous, there's no need for extrinsic analysis, there's no need for legislative history. It's a matter of the court taking that plain and unambiguous language and applying it and its meaning to the facts of this case.
I gather you think it's plain and unambiguous that the writer, the consumer, had to follow the language, or substantially the same language as in the statute.
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, so there's another rule of statutory interpretation that if the literal language reaches an absurd result, that you don't follow the literal language. And the absurd result comes when the statute is, the literal language of it defeats the whole underlying purpose, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
So why can't the argument be, look, the literal language here defeats the purpose of the statute, which is to protect consumers?
Well,
they don't read the statutes, right? People don't walk around with the statute book.
Well, I agree, Your Honor, but the point of it is that the requirement that a notice be formulated in this case, which includes both an election of a remedy between repair and replacement and also an offer to transfer title of the vehicle, does not lead to an absurd result. I think it's pretty plain and clear from the statute what the consumer has to do to get a new vehicle, and that by including that language in the notice, there should be no problem in terms of the statute being complied with by the consumer and the process going forward. There's no absurd result that's reached here.
If you're going to repair the car, I'm not going to give you my title, right? I take my car in with some frequency.
Correct.
And I'm not turning in my title. But if I want a replacement car, suppose I buy a new car, and I'm going to trade in my old car, so it's kind of replacement, I come in with my title, right?
If you're going to trade it to the dealer, I would
say. Right. So why can't you say, once I say I want a replacement, by definition, it means I'm going to give you the title to my car, and you're going to give me a new car and a new title, right?
That does not necessarily follow.
Okay, tell me why.
A couple of reasons. First of all, the requirement to offer to transfer title, Your Honor, doesn't just apply to a replacement vehicle. It also applies to a refund under the statute. In other words, if I went and asked, instead of for a replacement vehicle, I asked for a refund, and I said nothing about whether I'm going to return the vehicle or transfer title, there's nothing in and of itself of that request which implies that I'm going to bring the vehicle back. And so, therefore, the language that the legislature chose to use here, offer to transfer title, applies whether we're dealing with a replacement vehicle or whether a refund. And I think that if, in fact, you take the position that it's implied by making a claim under the Lemon Law statute, you have essentially written that language out of the statute.
But isn't the manufacturer in control of that? I can't see a manufacturer that someone asked for a replacement car or a refund ever handing over anything without title to the car. So that's totally in the control of the manufacturer.
It isn't, Your Honor, because the statute specifically requires the manufacturer to pay the money, the refund,
right,
or provide the replacement vehicle,
right,
before they can they get the other vehicle back. In other words, if I, as a manufacturer, do not transfer or give the refund within 30 days, I have violated the statute, and
yeah,
I cannot demand.
The statute goes on to say, when the manufacturer provides a new motor vehicle or refund, the consumer shall return the motor vehicle. So
right.
To me, that sounds like you do it the same day.
The problem is first of all, you've got to turn the money over. You've got to turn the vehicle over. But the problem is, Your Honor, is that you don't know at that point whether the consumer indeed even has title to the vehicle. The Lemon Law statute and the cases that have been interpreted under it specifically indicate that ownership of the vehicle and having title to the vehicle is a prerequisite to making a claim under that statute. So in other words, if I make a demand for a refund under that statute and I say nothing about whether I'm willing to transfer title, the manufacturer doesn't know if you're even in a position to transfer title to the vehicle pursuant to that statute. You may no longer have it.
Well, and you may have a lien on it, which is, I think, common in purchasing an automobile, particularly a new one. But it seems to me that, you know, what you're asking us to do is to cause a consumer to put quotation marks around the words that are in the statute instead of saying, I want a replacement vehicle under the Lemon Law, and they can hire smart counsel like you to tell them what their responsibilities are.
Your Honor, the problem with that is that's not the scheme that the legislature chose. The legislature said you have to do two things, consumer. You have to elect a remedy,
right,
and you have to offer to transfer title to the vehicle.
She certainly elected a remedy, correct?
She did.
All right.
There,
And when she says that she makes her claim under the Lemon Law, I don't see anything in the statute that says the consumer must use these particular words.
Well, there's also, she says nothing about any willingness to either transfer title or return the vehicle, which the statute clearly requires.
Well, it requires her to offer to transfer title. I guess my biggest concern with all of this is that you got a 30-day obligation once the offer is made. But I can, I have to say I'm concerned about if what she said to you the first time wasn't sufficient. I mean, why doesn't Mazda bear any responsibility for saying, you have to transfer title to us if we're going to do this? I mean, why don't people just communicate instead of coming to us in court? Why don't they straighten this out?
First of all, Your Honor, the Behrens case, the Court of Appeals indicated in that case is that it's not up to the manufacturer to construe or interpret the Lemon Law statute. In that case, the consumer was arguing that the manufacturer should have called up the consumer and said, well, what remedy do you really want under the statute?
I'm familiar with the case, but that's not where we are here. You knew what the remedy was. You sold her the car, so you had a very good idea about probably the financing was on it. I mean, I don't know why we have to get in a standoff where one person makes it so difficult for the other one to comply with the law.
Your Honor, you had asked earlier why this case is still going.
Yeah,
and,
right.
And I will explain to you why this case is still going. It's about double damages and attorney's fees. The case started, and there were negotiations between Mazda and Ms. Garcia. And ultimately, Mazda offered, as part of those negotiations, a replacement vehicle. And, in fact, Ms. Garcia went down to the Hall dealership and ordered a replacement vehicle.
Right, I read that.
The file will further reflect that in December of 2001, I got involved and specifically wrote plaintiff's counsel and indicated that the replacement vehicle was there and that it was available to be picked up. And at that point, a lawsuit had been started, a claim had been made for double damages and as well as attorney's fees. So the reason this case isn't settled is because in the interim after the replacement vehicle was ordered, the decision was made to start a lawsuit against Mazda for double damages and attorney's fees, and that's why it continues on today. That's why there hasn't been another Lemon Law demand. Your Honor asked earlier why wasn't there another Lemon Law demand?
The first one's not right.
There hasn't been one in the last 2 years because of the fact that if, in fact, one would be made by the statute and the decision would be made to replace the vehicle, then this case would go by the wayside, the double damages would go by the wayside, and the attorney's fees that counsel have incurred up to this point would also be unrecoverable. So I would submit to you, Your Honor, the reason this case has gone on is not as a result of Mazda being greedy, as counsel has suggested, but rather it's a result of the double damages and the attorney's fees, which will go away if, in fact, the Court of Appeals decision is affirmed on the basis that it's been set forth so far.
I have another question for you along the same lines. Why did Mazda ask her to pay sales tax on the vehicle?
They never did, Your Honor. There is nothing in the record that suggests that Mazda ever demanded the payment of sales tax or fees. What happened was is that the offer was made through Mazda saying, we'll provide you a replacement vehicle. Please send us what we need to be able to process this. She went down and ordered the vehicle. At no time did any Mazda representative ever indicate to her that you had to pay sales tax and attorney's fees or sales tax and license fees, et cetera. What happened was is that the purchase contract or an order form was filled out at the dealership. There was some comment by the dealer that maybe sales tax had to be paid, et cetera. The purchase contract or the order form that was filled out was actually sent back to Mazda by Ms. Garcia with no comments about, are you asking me to pay income or sales tax, registration fees? Mm-hmm. And at no time was there ever any demand made by Mazda for the payment of sales tax or registration fees as
Counsel,
it relates to this vehicle.
Circuit Court judge concluded to the contrary. It concluded against you with regard to a genuine issue of material fact
regarding the $1,200 in taxes along with other title fees. Is that correct?
Your Honor, I'm hesitating only because it was unclear to me as to whether the judge was ruling as a matter of law that he felt there was no settlement agreement reached or whether he felt there was an issue of fact. I would submit that the record, a review of the record, would indicate that that was never an element of the offer that was made to Ms. Garcia, that at no time did Mazda ever insist that sales tax or registration fees be paid, and that it was never part of the deal, the settlement deal between Mazda and the plaintiff.
This case is procedurally before us on a motion for summary judgment, so regardless of whether he concluded as a matter of law there was no agreement, or he concluded that there exists genuine issue of material fact as to whether or not agreement was present. Either way, he denied the motion for summary judgment against you. Is that correct?
No, he granted summary judgment
on that issue.
Oh,
right?
I'm sorry.
For instance, let's say, let's just get to it. After granting the motion on summary judgment with regard to the offer of transferring title, he said, with regard to the additional request in the alternative, notwithstanding that both parties put things in motion, it's quite clear there was not a specific agreement with regard to a vehicle being provided to Ms. Garcia. The reason I indicate that is that looking at the information here, there in fact was a vehicle ordered. But even at the time that that occurred, there was disagreement as to the dealership indicated there was going to be more than $1,200 in taxes along with other title fees. He goes on the next page to indicate that that issue needed to be addressed and resolved on an upfront basis for them, that is Mazda, to say, yes, we have an agreement, therefore she should take delivery of the vehicle and figure out at some time later what additional sums may be owed, tells me no. There was not a complete agreement here that would otherwise be enforceable. So for that reason as well, I'm satisfied there was not an agreement that is otherwise enforceable. So there was something in the record, I haven't read the whole record, just the judge's decision that he had before him, that you were claiming $1,200 in taxes together with title fees and additional sums which may be owed after she took delivery that would be figured out later.
That's
his understanding of the evidence, anyway.
Your Honor, that was an affidavit that had been submitted by Ms. Garcia in opposition to our motion. It was her position that when, upon talking to the salespeople at Hall, that they told her they would have to pay that additional tax and registration and license fees. And it was our position on summary judgment that there was that while the salesperson, even if we assume that the salesperson made that statement, that statement was never made by or insisted upon by anybody from Mazda in terms of the settlement deal. And secondly, that at no point, and that the salesman further indicated, according to her own affidavit, that the salesman suggested that it would have to be discussed or something with Mazda further once the vehicle was delivered. So it was our basis is that was never part of the settlement agreement. There was never any insistence by Mazda that any sales tax or registration fees be paid, and as a result, they were willing and able to comply with the agreement that had been reached.
It's your position that the circuit court erroneously exercised its discretion when arriving at its decision.
We believe that in terms of its decision as it relates to the settlement, the court was erroneous in not concluding as a matter of law that settlement had been reached in this case and enforcing it as an alternative ground for granting summary judgment. Now, when I was talking about the construction of the statute, I did want to make one reference, and that is that in discussing these various issues here today, the petitioners here have failed to cite any legal authority in support of their position. And I would submit to the court that the various decisions that have been handed down by the Court of Appeals on the Lemon Law clearly illustrate and again reiterate the fact that there is a two-prong element for every notice that has to be served under this particular statute. In the Church case, where the Court of Appeals in that case said the 30-day limit is the 30-day limit. You've got to provide a refund within 30 days. You've got to provide a replacement vehicle within 30 days. And the court there indicated that the statute clearly requires that the manufacturer issue a refund within 30 days of the consumer's offer to transfer title. Therefore, once the consumer makes an offer to transfer title, the burden is on the manufacturer to comply with the 30-day requirement, regardless of whether items or amounts are in dispute. So again, the Court of Appeals in that case is indicating that there is an obligation on the part of the consumer to transfer title. If we went on and talked about another case...
Counsel, before you get to that case, that raises in my mind a question, I guess, that's been lingering, and that is, if you didn't think the October 24th notice gave you notice that she was asking for a replacement under the Lemon Law, then why did you order a replacement and get it delivered?
Well, initially, Your Honor, it started out, as the record will reflect, that they attempted to negotiate a settlement of the case on the basis of a payment of a few car payments and extended warranty. And in fact, in the interim, there were some additional repair attempts that were made to the vehicle. I think toward the end, after the letter was received, the vehicle was brought in. There were some additional efforts at repairing it. And then Ms. Garcia drove it for a while, and then there was some recontact by Mazda saying, is the vehicle fixed? Are you willing to take a couple of payments and extended warranty to resolve this? And at that point, Ms. Garcia said, no, I want a replacement vehicle. And at that point, the discussion then went on between Mazda and Ms. Garcia, and Mazda decided that to resolve this consumer difference, they wanted to replace the vehicle. Would be ordered because at that point there were none in stock at the dealership.
So you were going to give her a replacement vehicle even though she hadn't given you notice under the Lemon Law that that's what she was asking for.
Right. I mean, even if the consumer...
Even though you didn't, I mean, it's your position, you didn't have to, but you just wanted
right.
to order her a replacement
not at
vehicle.
Not at that basis.
Goodwill or something.
At that point, there was no obligation to do it. On the other hand, the consumer rep that was handling it understood that there were some problems with the car. They understood that the consumer was no longer happy with the car and that at some point was probably going to be pursuing some type of a remedy, whether it be the Lemon Law, Magnuson Moss, or whatever, and a decision was made at that point to try and resolve it on that basis.
Was this a lemon under the definition of Lemon Law?
Well, that issue was never really addressed.
Are you disputing that, or are you conceding that?
I think we have not conceded that for purposes of this litigation. We've conceded it for purposes of summary judgment in the sense that to the extent that we're talking about the notice and whether or not it was valid, we're assuming, at least for that purpose, that the other statutory requirements were met, but we have never conceded that the vehicle meets the criteria under the statute.
What about when it was out of service? How many days was it between Montana and Wisconsin? I forget.
I don't know, Your Honor. I think that when the letter was sent to us, the indication was it was 19 days and out of service, according to Ms. Garcia, and there were probably some additional repair attempts made, but... there's no doubt that there were some problems with the vehicle.
I think the dates are here, repairs and billings on September 5th, and then on October 5th, she picked up her vehicle at Hall Imports. Does that sound about right?
That probably is consistent with the record, Your Honor.
And how many days does it have to be out of service before it comes within the definition of Lemon Law?
Well, if you're using the 30-day requirement, it would have to be out of service 30 days during the first year for warranty nonconformities as defined by the statute, or the other option is four or more repair attempts and the problem continues during the first year for the same warranty nonconformity. Those are the two separate standards that the statute provides to the consumer.
I gather you're here to support the Court of Appeals decision.
Yes, Your Honor. I think
anything about it that you'd change?
No, Your Honor, I think that the Court of Appeals decision is indeed, I think, reflective of almost every justice, except for the dissent in that case, that has come across this question. First of all, we had the Barron's case, and the trial court in that case was faced both with the election of remedies issue as well as the issue of the need to transfer title, and the trial judge in that case felt that the statutory language required not only an election of remedies, but the need to transfer title or an offer to transfer title in some fashion. The Court of Appeals in that case didn't take up that issue, but that it certainly indicated in a footnote, and what I would be dicta, that the prudent practice would be to offer to transfer title consistent with the statutory language. Judge Dreyfus found essentially the same in terms of his interpretation of the statute and the two justices in the Court of Appeals. And I think they were correct in their interpretation in the sense that you've got clear statutory language. The offer to transfer title is clearly made a prerequisite and part of the notice. It has not only the effect of advising the manufacturer of the willingness and the position of the consumer to be able to comply with the statute because they can transfer title, but it's also the linchpin that starts the 30-day period. I mean, there's nothing in that statute which would suggest that the 30-day period is started by notice that says, I want a refund or I want a replacement vehicle. That doesn't start the statutory language.
What about a notice that says, take this lemon back? Give me a replacement.
Now, Your Honor, I think that might be a little bit more of a borderline in the sense that there indeed is, in that sense, a request to take back the vehicle. Now, I think the statutory language is clear that you're supposed to transfer title. It says an offer to transfer title. I think that the court and Judge Dreyfus suggested, well, you know, maybe you can get by saying there is an offer to return the vehicle. And I would suggest that that's a closer call, but that in this case, you have none of that in the sense that you have no offer by the consumer to even return the vehicle.
Well, you do have an offer. You do have a demand for a replacement, right?
Right.
And what's the common ordinary definition of replacement?
Well,
an additional vehicle or one to swap out for the one you've got?
To replace what you have. Now,
you're not going to keep both. I mean, the ordinary common definition of replacement is, I'll give you mine back, you give me another.
True.
So why is that not good enough?
Because then I don't know how you carve this statute up because of the fact that you're talking about refund, too. I mean, the question under the statute or the statutory language says you have to offer to transfer title, whether it be in a refund situation or whether it be in a replacement situation. I don't give the same connotation to someone asking for a refund as a willingness to return the vehicle. Particularly where the statute allows for double damages. I mean, in the sense that you could have a consumer that is actually requesting a relief under that statute and has every intention on keeping that vehicle because they think they're entitled to double damages.
Well, the fact that you've got a very blunt instrument at the other end of this equation, that being the double damages and the attorney's fees, wouldn't that lend some support for an interpretation that errs on the side of liberality, that you would interpret anything that even comes close to the line of meeting the statute, that you would construe that as an appropriate demand under the statute and deal with it appropriately?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And the reason I say that is that the same argument was made by the plaintiffs in the Barron's case. And the Court of Appeals there actually said, because of the stringent requirements of that statute, the 30 days means 30 days, a refund or replacement within 30 days, we feel that it's only fair under the circumstances that the consumer be required to meet what we believe to be plainly established obligations and conditions under the statute.
Doesn't that turn the statute on its head, though?
No, it doesn't.
This is a consumer self-executing remedial statute.
And I completely disagree with the plaintiff's connotation that this turns the statute on its head, that somehow it's now not self-enforcing. I stood back and made a list of what a pro se plaintiff would have to figure out if, in fact, they were going to make a claim under this Lemon Law statute based upon the language, et cetera, of the statute. They'd have to figure out, first of all, that they need to elect a remedy between refund and replacement. They'd have to figure out for themselves what they were entitled to in terms of a refund. They'd have to figure out what might be the better circumstance for them between a refund or a replacement, because with a refund, you can get a deduction for reasonable use, a reasonable allowance for use. With a replacement vehicle, you don't necessarily get that. They have to figure out what collateral costs they might be entitled to and what they would have to ask the manufacturer for. And they have to figure out whether or not they complied with the 30 days out of service, four more repair attempts. I mean, that's all that's in that statute that, at least according to the plaintiffs and the states and the amicus briefs, make it self-enforcing. Now, to now include in that a requirement that they elect remedies, and also at the same time plainly set forth in the statute to offer to transfer title, to me doesn't set the statute on its ear. It doesn't give them, it doesn't set forth any more requirements or any more interpretation than what they already, the statute already requires of anybody who's going to sit down and make a claim under those circumstances. I mean, I think that the way, you know, the way the statute has been interpreted thus far and the way the language has been written, it is a pro-consumer statute. And I think that the courts that have interpreted it, and in fact, in the situations where people who have given up the vehicle and then made a claim, and the courts have said, you've got to be able to return the vehicle if you want remedies under this statute. The courts said it may be remedial in nature, but that in and of itself isn't going to allow us to conjure up or create remedies or interpretations that are contrary to its plain meaning. And then Barron's case went on, I think, to say the same thing.
Do you understand the Court of Appeals majority opinion to stand for the proposition that the explicit statutory language must be used, otherwise the notice is insufficient?
No, I don't understand that as their position at all. In fact, I don't think the dissent even understood that as their position. The dissent said, I agree that the statute is clear and unambiguous that you need to elect a remedy and transfer title. And that, but the dissent felt that the mere request for relief under the statute as a replacement vehicle was enough.
So the statute, according to your interpretation and that of the majority opinion in the Court of Appeals, requires an offer to transfer title, but it does not require that offer to be made in any particular form.
Correct. I don't think you. It certainly doesn't require. Just as you can elect a remedy between replacement or refund, and it certainly doesn't require that you say I am hereby offering to transfer title. I think that it does require that I'm going to provide you with the vehicle upon receipt of the remedy. I'm going to present the vehicle to you, the nonconforming vehicle to you upon receipt of the remedy. I'm offering you the vehicle in return for the remedy that I've elected under the statute. I think that has to be in that notice as part of that two-prong approach, because quite frankly, I don't see if the legislature really wanted to have said what this the interpretation that's being proposed here today by the petitioner, they could have easily said that without using the terms offer to transfer title. But what they did do is that in 1987, when the statute was amended to include this specific language, they specifically indicated that to receive a refund under the statute, you must offer to transfer title to the vehicle. That language wasn't in there previously. And I think it makes it clear that what they're doing is creating a requirement. So I see that my time's up. And
I don't want you to sit down, though. Don't sit down.
Okay.
I have one other question. Just say I agree with your opposing counsel's interpretation that the notice they gave you was sufficient, but I have concerns about whether, in fact, you really did try to comply with the statute. I understood opposing counsel to say that the trial court found questions of fact on your motion for summary judgment about whether settlement had been reached. If I would take that approach, would I need to remand it back for a trial on whether Mazda did do what the statute required it to do, in other words, provide a replacement vehicle in a timely fashion?
No, I think, Your Honor, that what we'd have to do, the record would have to be reviewed to determine whether or not there is an issue of fact as it relates to whether a settlement had been reached.
Well, but what I was looking at is, and perhaps I misunderstood what you said. I've read the affidavits and so forth that are in the record, but I thought opposing counsel said the trial court found there were too many questions of fact to give you summary judgment that there had been a settlement reached. Okay. My concern is it settlement in compliance with the statute? And I thought from your answers to my questions that you didn't ask her to pay the sales taxes and you didn't require that she pay the transfer fees. Now, I know there's an affidavit from her in there saying the opposite. Okay, so if in fact your interpretation is correct, it would satisfy perhaps your obligation under the statute. And would then that require remand for trial to find out whether the trial court believes your interpretation of the facts or her interpretation of the facts? Am I making any sense to you at all?
I think I know where you're going.
Okay. All right.
Is my position, Your Honor, that there are no issues, material issues of fact, which would preclude the granting of summary judgment on that issue. I think that the questions of whether or not a demand was made for sales tax or registration were never a part of the understanding or agreement between Mazda and the plaintiff.
That's not what she says.
She says it was told to her by the salesperson at Hall Imports, and it was never made a part of any understanding or agreement that she had with Mazda. In fact, the agreement that she had with Mazda, which I believe is reflected by the record in the affidavits, is that a replacement vehicle was offered by Mazda. And Ms. Garcia responded by saying, I agree to that, and furthermore, I am going to provide you with information so that we can process the replacement vehicle, and I'm going to go order a replacement vehicle, and that there were never any discussions between Mazda and the plaintiff regarding the payment of any sales tax or registration fees. It simply wasn't a part of the agreement.
But couldn't she have interpreted the response of the sales rep at the agency to mean that that was what she had to do, even though Mazda didn't say so?
I don't think that's a fair reading of it for two reasons. First of all, the salesman ultimately says, you'll have to talk to Mazda about it. And secondly, she then takes the order form and sends it to Mazda saying, I went down to the dealer and I ordered it, and there's never any discussion or any suggestion about, the salesman says I have to pay sales tax and registration fees. I'm not going to do it, or that wasn't part of our agreement, or anything like that. Mm-hmm. And the point of the matter is that it simply wasn't, and that the agreement was between the plaintiff and Mazda to provide a replacement vehicle, and that this entire idea that registration or sales tax fees is just a red herring that's been conjured up to an event to preclude the finding of a settlement here, because again, it does away with the double damages and attorney's fees.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Bocan.
Thank you. I just heard that there were some red herrings here, and I'd like to point out a couple of them. One is, we've heard a lot about this refund versus replacement, and this is somehow a big distinction. And I think that's definitely wrong. I think, regardless of whether it's a refund or replacement, if it's under the Lemon Law, she's going to transfer title. Plus, if we look at the common fair meaning of the word refund, I don't see how that's much different than replacement. If you go to Kmart and you bring something back and you ask for a refund, you know that you're going to leave that item you brought in with. You aren't going to get both the refund and the item. And I think that's very similar to the concept of replacement. But either way, if under the Lemon Law she's required to transfer title, I don't think that it matters. We also, the one we just left, the whole issue of what the dealer told my client. Remember, the reason she's at the dealer is not because she had a burning desire to go to Hall, but it's because Mazda told her, go to a Mazda dealer. In fact, go to Hall, a particular Mazda dealer. And then it's at the Mazda dealer where they told her she was going to have to pay these additional monies. In addition, in the record, in her affidavit, she says that Bonnie Felt, the representative from Mazda that told her to go to Hall, the Mazda dealer, also told her that she was going to have to pay a mileage charge. So I think to say that, to blame this all on Hall, I don't think is fair, and I think the record is clear that, in fact, she was at Hall because Mazda told her to go to Hall, its dealer.
Is there any way on this record that a jury could find that Mazda did deem her notice of a replacement vehicle sufficient and agreed to provide her a car, and that for whatever reason at the last minute she refused to accept it?
I don't think so, because under the Lemon Law, there's specific law out there, Herzberg, Sheraton, that says that you can't impose additional conditions.
Right, and I understand that, and I agree with that. That's you don't need to persuade me of that. My concern is with the representations I'm getting here of Mazda saying they, even though they don't think it's sufficient under the statute, they treated it as sufficient, and they tried to give her a new car, and the stuff about them requiring mileage and so forth is simply not accurate, that they never required mileage, never required transfer fees or anything. They had the car for her. And my question to you is, if we sent it back to a jury, would the jury decide they were right, or could the jury decide your client was right, that she rightfully believed she'd have to pay other things, and that's why she refused the car?
I think there's another reason why they can't possibly prevail, and that is because the vehicle was not provided within 30 days. And there's specific case law that the vehicle...
That's not my problem. That's not what's troubling my heart.
Okay.
What's troubling my heart is, did they try to give your client a vehicle? And did they put strings on it that were unacceptable under the statute? And that's the question I'm focusing on.
I think they did try to give her a vehicle. They tried to charge her monies and wanted an extension of the time to get it to her. But I think they tried to provide her with a vehicle because I think retroactively, when they couldn't talk her into taking payments or an extended warranty, they decided, well, the jig's up. I guess we'll have to give her what the statute says we have to give her. And they treated her that way, I believe, because she was a pro se consumer. And in fact, I think that this is exactly the type of mischief that this statute was created to take care of, so that somebody like Del Garcia, who's not represented, won't be offered a few payments or an extended warranty when Mazda knows what it owes her is a new vehicle. And it wasn't until she insisted that they finally acquiesced, albeit even then trying to tie additional conditions, making her pay money and giving them more time. And the whole reason they needed more time is because they tried to trick her into accepting payments or an extended warranty first. And that's something that they did, I believe, because she was a pro se consumer. And that's wrong. That's the mischief that this statute was created to resolve.
Counsel, you're asking that this court reverse the Court of Appeals. Now, does that mean then that this matter is remanded back to the circuit court for trial?
I think since this was a summary judgment motion, I think on the issue before this court, it does indeed go back on the settlement agreement issue. I've taken the position that this court should not be looking at the settlement agreement issue. But if this court chooses to look at the settlement agreement issue and decides that under the law it couldn't possibly be a settlement agreement regardless of the facts, then there would be no need for a trial. On the other hand, if this court decided that there could be a settlement agreement depending on the facts, then I think this case would have to be remanded to the circuit court for trial on the facts. I see my red lights on unless somebody wants me to stand here further.
How about double damages and attorney's fees?
Double damages and attorney fees are the penalty that sub 7 of the Lemon Law builds when the manufacturer does not comply with the Lemon Law. And in fact, in this case, where we see the kind of mischief going on, offering her additional payments and extended warranty, I think not only does she deserve double damages and attorney fees, I think she deserves a plaque for taking this further and trying to help other consumers, because the kind of mischief that Mazda engaged in is wrong.
Now, do we make that decision, or does it go back on attorney fees and double damages? I assume if it goes back on the settlement issue, the entire issue goes back.
I believe, consistent with what has occurred in other appellate cases, I think the circuit court would actually be the court that would do the math, that would figure what the damages were, and the damages would be the double damages and the attorney's fees, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
That concludes our hearing on 02-2260, Adele R. Garcia versus Mazda Motor of America, Inc. We hear a lemon law case. We haven't heard one for a while. I do want to...